Accession number 18202, Reel 3.
Mr. Fowles, Reel 3.
To continue about the incendiary cans, we used to have to load these things up, and as far as I remember, it was a tremendous amount of these little incendiary bombs, which I believe used to be about a pound or perhaps a pound and a half in weight. That was my impression. So in quite a large can, which was fairly deep as well as being long, there could have been, I suppose, anything up to 1,000 of these things. And what happened was that the actual canister stayed up in the aeroplane, and the sort of bars which secured the things across were sprung by the bomb aimer, and out went these showers of incendiary bombs, and that's why they were so lethal and dangerous, whoever was dropping them, and wherever they were dropped. Now, in addition to those, we also had to handle the big bombs, you know, the sort of 500 pounds and over, and of course some of them towards, you know, when we were there, 44, they were getting up to these tall boys and things, and Lancasters could carry a fantastic load of bombs, much, much more than a flying fortress. There were jokes about that, of course. Famous song about the Americans with the flying fortresses and the teeny weeny bomb. But that's perhaps being a little partisan. These other bombs that we handled were the phosphorus bombs. Pretty lethal things, I should think. Nasty things, you know, if you can imagine. Again, as far as I can remember, they were about, well, I got the impression they were about 25 to 30 pounds in weight, but they were a design bomb. In other words, they had fins on, they were the bomb shape, you know, the aerodynamic shape. And, of course, they had these little fuses. They were armed with these fuses, which were screwed into the nose of the bomb, just like the big boys. And all these arming was done, of course, by the armourers proper in the armouries and the bomb dumps. And then the bombs were sent over on trolleys, and it was our job then to help in actually bombing up the Lancasters. And I can well remember, and it didn't occur to me or to any of the other chaps who were doing this at the time, how dangerous this could have been, because no one stopped us, but we simply used a human chain from, say, a bomb trolley with all these phosphorus bombs on, over to the aircraft that was being bombed up. And it's a bit like passing bricks from one chap to the next. And we didn't have quite that many people, and we were usually, I suppose, 5 or 6 yards between each other. And to begin with, we used to carry them to one another, and we were quite careful with them. But after doing this for some weeks, we used to toss the things to each other. And Lord only knows what would have happened if the damn thing had dropped, because they were armed, you see. The fuses were in, the detonators were screwed in. And I often think now just the amount of damage that not only would have been done to we chaps, but to the general surrounds, including the aircraft. You know, there could have been some nasty accidents there, but no one ever stopped us doing this, and it rather amazed me, and particularly in retrospect, you know, you think back about these things. That was something that, you know, sort of habit breeds contempt, I suppose, you could say that. But at least I felt at the time that we were doing something, you know, towards the effort. And it was during that stay, that 7 or 8 weeks that we had there, that I managed to get one flip in a Lancaster. It was purely a practice flight, and it was on 57 Squadron. I don't know, without looking it up, whether I've got a note of the aircraft letter or serial number. I don't think I have. And I certainly don't remember any of the names of the crews, but I asked if they had room for me, if they were doing a practice flight, and someone said yes, see the skipper, and I saw the skipper, and he said yes, you can go, and he put me in the mid-upper turret, and I got into this thing, and we took off, and I was shaken rigid, because the two huge fins, you know, in the tail of the Lancaster, they were literally, looked to me, to be moving about 6 inches. They were just sort of vibrating with the whole aircraft. And apparently this was quite normal, but it certainly shook me. Anyway, we went off, and they were doing practice bombing over the Wash. You've got to remember, the war was still definitely on. It was this would be January, February 44, and we dived right down onto the water and dropped bombs from low level. Then we did some higher level bombing all around the Wash, but still in the open sea. And he was throwing the thing about something terrible. And I discovered afterwards that this was known as corkscrewing. In other words, when you'd been at a target, or at night if you got into searchlights over enemy territory, you would take avoiding action, which was popularly known as corkscrewing. And this involved slinging this blooming great aeroplane round like no one's business. Well, it was probably all right for the chaps who were doing it regularly and were part of the official crew. Here I was in this mid-upper turret without any real visible means of support apart from this little plank thing that you pulled across your bottom and joined up to a stud or something on the side, I can't remember. And so after 2.5 hours of this, I was beginning to feel just a bit on the airsick side. And I'd never been airsick before, not that I'd done much flying at this stage, and I'd never been airsick since. But this time, I thought I might just make it. And so anyway, after this 2.5 hours, we came back and we landed at East Kirkby. At least I thought we were going to land. And I was ready to get out very quickly. And he must have balked his landing, or the second dicky was perhaps being given a bit of practice. And we touched down on the runway and immediately took off again, went round again. And that was a bit too much for me. I just about made it to the Elzan in the back, but it wasn't a sort of perfect aim on my part, and of course that was one of the occasions when I had to clean everything up. But that, I remember that because that's the only time I've ever been airsick. But these chaps were very good, and again, we never had a chance really of talking and living with them, because they were separate people. The NCOs had their mess, the officers had their mess, and we were just billeted in odd huts and went and fed in the airman's mess. So we didn't really get much of a chance to hobnob with the air crews, which I'd like to have done. But in any case, I was convinced at this stage that I wasn't going to go on bombers. I wanted to go on fighters. And then from there on, of course, we finally, after that East Kirkby sojourn, we went back to Eaton Park again, and then after a little while, I forget how long, we were sent up to Gourock on the Clyde, and after hanging about there for a day or two, we went aboard, and we went aboard the Monarch of Bermuda. It was a beautiful ship. I think it was about 26 or 26,500 tons. I'm not even sure which line she was, but you should have made more inquiries. But the way the beautiful teak rails, you know, the ship's rails had been gouged deeply with people's initials and that, it was just sheer vandalism. And that was an interesting journey, because we had to go south across the Bay of Biscay. I was then told, whether it was true or not, I don't know, but this chap told me that we were the first convoy to go through the Med. up until then, it was right round the Cape and so forth. It could have been the first convoys with the Med. We were certainly well escorted by destroyers, who every now and again would race round us and start dropping depth charges. Whether this was sheer panic or whether it was just hopefulness, I don't know. But it was all quite exciting. And before that Mediterranean interval on the ship, when we left Gourock, they found that one or two chaps were suffering from scarlet fever. And I think it was scarlet fever. It was a very, very contagious disease, or infectious disease. And crossed the Bay of Biscay. And that was another time when my love of food was satisfied, because I think there were three of us on our mess table, which was about 20-odd cadets. And we had to take it in turn to be mess orderlies and go and get our food from the ship's galley in these huge naval dixies. Well, as we went across the Bay of Biscay, I think all but three of us had been violently sick. I'd managed to get up onto the weather bridge on some occasions and managed to get very sticky with salt water and wind, but it seemed to keep me from being too sick. And then we go down and we go and draw our full rations for 20-odd men, so that we'd stagger back with about three or four of these huge dixies of food. Not that the food was particularly good, but we used to finish most of it, and were quite disappointed when we got to Gibraltar, and most of these chaps had recovered, and they put more of these scarlet fever or whatever it was cases ashore, thinking that they'd now cleared the thing. When we set, we didn't actually land at Gibraltar, but when the ship sailed again from Gib, there were still cases going sick with this, so they hadn't done anything about it. But the upshot of it was that we were confined to, now what was it, the starboard side, I think, starboard weather deck, and there were some 800 air cadets, air training cadets, air crewed cadets, confined to this one starboard side weather deck, which of course was open. And as we got into the tropics, into the Med, and then through the Suez Canal, we were still there, and as far as they were concerned, there was still the scarlet fever about. And you were literally, during the day, walking on bodies. You had to be very careful, because there were 800 on this deck, and they were just lying there in the sun and touching each other. And a thing that I did see there, which I'd never forget, we had emergency rations. We always had to wear a life jacket, except when we were in our hammocks. And we were issued with survival rations, which were largely tins of very dark chocolate, which we found out afterwards. And these were sealed, these tins, of course, so they would last a long time. And we used to tie these to our life jackets. We already had our aircrew whistles issued to us, which were on our battle dress and things like that. And these chaps, and I couldn't believe my eyes when I first saw it, but I saw this chap with a pair of scissors. And by this time, you see, we were well into the Med and there was no more seasickness. And this chap, as fellows went past him, this tin of chocolate was dangling from there, was there, and he just neatly snipped the emergency ration tin from his life jacket. So at least it warned me, and I took precautions against that. I always kept mine in my pocket. But it just goes to show what people will do, you know, when conditions demand it. And the conditions were that these fellows, particularly they got over the seasickness, and they were hungry, and the rations weren't sufficient. So this is a small thing, but I shan't forget that. Then, of course, we went through Suez, and that was most interesting. Still not allowed off the ship. whenever we hove to, it would be outside of harbour or in the outer reaches of the harbour. I know we had a few hours stop at Alexandria. Then we went through the Suez Canal. We stopped at the southern end. I don't know how long for now. I can't remember. But the after that, we then went down, and the next stop was at Mombasa.
I think I have to go.
We got to Mombasa, and it looked very green, very nice, and just these sort of lowish sheds on the quay. But we were still not allowed off. And then the next stop after that was at Durban, and this was Mecca. I mean, we come from wartime England, where when you had food, it wasn't all that quality. And here we were. As soon as we got off the ship in Durban and went to Clarewood Camp, which was the transit camp, we were finding that on the mess tables there were half a dozen different types of jam that you could help yourself to. Some jams that we never even heard of. We certainly hadn't seen much in wartime England. And within a matter of a couple of days, I would say that a good 40 to 50% of our draft, that was the 800 or so that were on the ship, were down with jippy tummy, dysentery, whatever you like to call it. Because this food, you know, we tended to make pigs of ourselves, I think. But it was a really magnificent place. And it was there in Durban, incidentally, and I remember this now, I forget her name, I did hear about her since, but a rather large lady in white with beautiful hat was on the quay as we docked at Durban, singing to us through a megaphone. And she was singing all sorts of English songs, you know, "There'll Always Be an England" and "Land of Hope and Glory" and all these things. And I was subsequently told, many years later, that she had met every troop ship that came to South Africa from the West. I'm sure she's well documented. I forget her name, unfortunately. But it was wonderful, you know, just this little welcome from this large but seemingly small figure on the quay was seen to us, and that was very nice. We stayed at Clarewood, I would say, a week or two, I can't remember. And then we got on the train and we went up country and we went to a place called Benoni, which I think translated from the biblical language means "son of my sorrow," I believe. Rather nice little town to the, I can't remember, I think it's a bit east of Joburg, along the Rand, or the Reef, as you call it in English, the Gold Reef. That was very nice there. We had our own pupil pilot's mess at last. Became reunited with tiger moths, and again I'd have to refer to my logbook, but I think we probably did round about 80 or 90 hours in tiger moths, which included pretty well everything except gunnery. We didn't drop anything or shoot anything. It was purely the flying, and we flew around cross countries in South Africa, turning points at little dorps and places where there was just a silo and a couple of houses, and you had to find these places in the middle of the veldt. All very interesting, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. We got, another chap and I got Pally. Matter of fact, the other chap was a fellow called Cliff Smiley. And Cliff, I heard many, many, many years later, probably or as late as the late 70s, I heard from a chap who reckoned he'd known this Cliff Smiley, who was living in Wales somewhere, that Cliff purported to be a wing commander. I wouldn't be at all surprised if he hadn't finished up as a wing commander, because he was that type. And he was mad on horses, and so was I. And we got pally with a local couple who had a number of horses, and we used to ride out with them, and I learned an awful lot from them. We did night riding, which of course is quite dangerous in the ordinary way. We did all sorts of things there. Their name was Matheson. I forget his name, but her name was Jean. Awfully nice woman. And we used to go up there whenever we had a few hours off for sports afternoon. We'd go up to the bungalow and ride the horses and exercise them and so forth. Wonderful place, and you'd be under the blue gum trees, and it was great South Africa. It was a place that I would willingly have gone back to. So then when we finished our what was known as the elementary flying training school, that was the Tiger Moth stage, we were then sent to SFTS, which again you will probably know stands for Service Flying Training School. And having completed that course, you are then presented with your wings or your flying badge or your brevet, as some people call it, from the original French. And we had a wonderful time there. And that SFTS was 27 Air School, 27 SFTS at Bloemspruit, which is just near Bloemfontein in the Orange Free State. That was very much more South African, from the European South African's point of view, than we had had at Benoni or anywhere else in South Africa. And that was a nice place. And again, we had our own mess. I shut off my mouth once or twice there and shouldn't have done, particularly as the chief ground instructor was around both times, and I think that tended to hold me back a bit later on.
Shut off your mouth about what?
Well, I remember one stage, it was only a week or two before we actually passed out and got our wings, and I insinuated rather sillily that certain people, and maybe it might even include certain ground officers who were not exactly appropriating our mess funds, but it seemed suspiciously like it, or some stupid words to this effect, and I should have had more common sense, and I might have done a bit better subsequently. But anyway, I got my wings eventually, but I didn't get these. At this stage, by the way, one had done about 200 and... I think I did about 260-something hours flying, and you were then presented with your wings. We were the last course to be trained at Bloemspruit, Bloemfontein. We passed out on the 30th of March, 1945. The chap who pinned our wings on our breasts was... Dr. Something Barnard, which was a good old Boer name, and he was the administrator of the Orange Free State, or the Boers used to prefer us to call it the Oranje Vrystaat. Very amusing. But we had then, I think, about a week after we got our wings, and we had a wonderful time. We threw dances and had all the local girls in, and it was great stuff. Thoroughly enjoyed ourselves. And then we were sent up to the Middle East, and we went up by Sunderland flying boat. It's the only time I've flown in the Sunderland flying boat. Several stages, about four or five stages. I can't remember many of them, but I can remember, oh Lord, no, I've forgotten places like... No. Anyway, I know we landed on Lake Victoria when we were in Kenya. There were stops in the Sudan. I think one place was Tabora. And it really when stopped for the evening and served by RAF mess boys, complete with RAF coloured sashes round their galabeers and turbans, one could sort of feel that one was going back in time about 50 years, you know, to the days of the Raj. Anyway, eventually we landed on the Nile in Cairo. We then went to Heliopolis, which is the transit camp there. Again, probably mosed around there for a little while. And then we were sent to RAF Fayid, F-A-Y-I-D, which is, or was, the one of the OTUs, that's Operational Training Unit, on the shores of one of the Bitter Lakes. I don't know whether it was the big one or the small one. But I know that there were a couple of Italian battleships out in the lake, which we never quite got out to. But I think they'd been surrendered sometime before and were stuck in the Bitter Lake there. Very dangerous, the Bitter Lakes. It was very foolish indeed to go in swimming without a fairly hefty pair of plimsolls on your feet, because some of the shells and that there, they had long, spiky spines on them, and these were dead shells, and would go through anything thin and right into your feet. That was that. Another time we'd hired a local fisherman's boat, about five of us, to go out sailing in the Bitter Lake. None of us had done any sailing before. And we were scudded out before the wind, and everything went well until we tried to get back. And then, of course, no one really knew how to tack or come about or anything like this. And we were getting further and further out, and we noticed that water was coming into this rather old, ancient vessel. And the next thing we knew was that the thing was not capsizing, it was slowly sinking. Discovered to my horror that one of my best pals, Eddie Head, who unfortunately is now dead, couldn't swim. So there we were, trying to rescue our uniforms and shoes and so forth from the locker under the prow of this rather ancient vessel. At the same time, responding to calls from Eddie, it was, "I can't swim, I can't swim." By this time, the thing had turned over and was actually floating in the water with a lot of it above the waterline. We got him onto this. And then along came another fishing boat, complete with its little charcoal stove in the bottom of their boat. And they then proceeded in best Egyptian fellaheen style to bargain with us as to how much it would we pay them to get us back to the shore. Anyway, we were prepared to pay anything to them at this stage. And a deal was struck and we were taken into shore. But we did not try to return the original boat to its owners. We scuttled off as quickly as we could. And that was, I think, my one and only experience of sailing before the wind. And most of it was before the wind. Very funny, very interesting. And then, as I say, we did our operational training unit at FIDE. And there were two aircraft there, two types of aircraft. We were allocated in the flights, one flight to one aircraft and one to the other. One was a big American aeroplane called the Thunderbolt. That's a P-47. I think it's North American that built that. Very